Welcome back to the podcast, Act in Context. My name's Tim Gordon.
And my name's Joanne Steinwalks.
We are joined by a wonderful guest. I am a mega fan of yours, Patty. We have Patricia Robinson, co-author on some of the most lean, mean, awesome ACT books. We're talking Brief Interventions for Radical Change. We're also talking about In This Moment. There's so many cool materials that you've released, Patty. It's wonderful to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
So Joanne, just before we were rolling, you were talking to Patty about how you got into ACT, and this was back in the days of comprehensive distancing. Is that true,
Patty? Well, Patty was telling us, she was in ACT before it was ACT.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it was, I think it was about 1985, and it's Seattle, Washington, and Kirk and I needed continuing education credits and saw a grand rounds at the University of Washington called Comprehensive Distancing. And we were like, well, what the heck is that? And so at that point, Steve had written one chapter. Wow. And we went over and listened to him and we were like, oh my gosh, this makes total sense. At the time, we were doing a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. It was Seattle, lots of depressed people. We were working in a specialty mental health clinic that was part of a HMO, it was really before it was an HMO in many ways, but it was a healthcare system that had primary care clinics and hospitals, and the mental health service was just one of many subspecialties. It also had a research arm, Center for Health Studies, and I worked part-time there. So I was part-time research and part-time mental health. And Steve's guidance was really, really useful to Kirk and I. We had kind of like a big group, CBT group program for depression. And we trained a lot of people to do a lot of groups. And
Patty, can you say what CDP is for people who might not know?
Cognitive Behavioral Therapy.
Okay.
CDP. Yeah. And so we took what we learned from him back, and we picked out all the people at the back of the folder, the referral folder, all the people that people didn't want for their groups. I mean, clinicians are really good at picking out non-responders.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we put them in a large group. We called it the Kingdom at the time. The big sports venue in Seattle was the Kingdom. Now it's Safeco Field. But and we had about 25 of these people, and we invited them, and we did four sessions of comprehensive distancing, and then we went into kind of a speedier version of our CBT skills-oriented kind of work. And it was, we kept like about 85% of the patients in the group.
And
they rated it, you know, positively, and we got some good numbers. And then we moved into collaborating with Steve.
Do you mind talking about what comprehensive distancing looked like when you and Kirk were doing it? Just quickly give us a shot of that.
Well, it had a lot of the elements, but the core processes had not been articulated. But the elements, the philosophy was there, and it didn't have the goal. So the goal, what is the purpose of using, you know, targeting processes? And so, psychological flexibility kind of was the term that came up over our dinner table.
Wow. So just to clarify, Patty, the thing that when you went to these grand rounds on comprehensive distancing, which sounds totally nerdy, by the way, but you go to these grand rounds, and the thing that stuck out to you that Steve Hayes was presenting at the time was the idea of having some distance from thoughts and acknowledging cognitive content rather than attempting to like restructure. Was that what the takeaway was? I'm really curious.
That's what I was wondering about,
It had all of the elements, I think, because one of the first experiments that I recall in the two-hour workshop was Eyes On.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Steve was able to kind of articulate in a Skinnerian kind of way what was happening in that exercise.
But that was a part of what he had presented all the way back in 1985.
In Grand Rounds, he's doing Eyes On. Holy moly.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it was great.
It sounds really cool.
Yeah, and then Kirk had been, I guess the other part of the story is Kirk had been at the University of Washington working with Marsha Linehan as her lead on the first research project on suicidal behavior. So he had written a treatment manual on the dialectical. And so the two just, I had more kind of what's coming at it from more of a Buddhist meditation kind of perspective. So it was like, we understood what we were talking about. You know, we understood it was a great conversation.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like weaving in that other way of kind of knowing like maybe some of the spiritual kind of knowledge as well. Wow.
You know, I don't think Buddhism is, you know, is necessarily a spiritual thing. I think of it more as a psychological technology. I mean, how to live with your mind, how to live with your brain, you know, is really, I think, what I take away from Buddhism.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And it's powerful power. These are powerful tools, hugely powerful tools.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people regard Buddhism as you know, like an early version of psychology, right? You know, like
to Buddha and Skinner, brothers from another mother. That's awesome. Right? Yeah. Anyway, we're getting off tangent. Sorry. Cool. So you were doing, you had this sense, Patty, of like familiarity with what Steve was saying. You weren't coming from such a CBT realm where thoughts need to be restructured, they need to be challenged. You had spent time observing your mind. So you understood what he was talking about. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then the other thing that was going on in my life at that time was our research team was moving into primary care and exploring delivery of behavioral interventions in the primary care context. And So
you've really been doing that pretty much all of your career, the primary care work.
Right.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Do you think do you think the ACT is disseminating well in primary care? Do you think primary care settings are starting to understand the importance of behavioral interventions?
Yeah, they really are. I mean, it's just a matter of getting the word out. I think they've always understood. They haven't ever had the time or training. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a story. It's just exciting to me. You know, we started out not knowing at all, kind of like, can we do anything in primary care and how brief can we be and make a difference? And so lots of questions about how to do this and whether it would really be helpful or not, and whether we would be welcomed by primary care. And so all of those things had to be studied and thought through. Lots of work over the past, I guess, almost 30 years. Yeah, 30 years since I first studied concerned older people in primary care. But most recently working with New Zealand, a healthcare organization in New Zealand, and starting a pilot that will go on for 3 years looking at delivery of behavioral health services in general practice settings, a variety of different practice settings in Auckland. We started with the assumption that all of the, they called the behavioral health providers working in this fully integrated capacity in this project, they call them health improvement practitioners or HIPs. It's good.
It is good.
It's really a great metaphor for primary care because during the first 6 months, we've had hip replacements and the right hip left and or the right hip came and the left hip left. And lots of fun.
Yeah. That is funny.
But it's interesting. the need is so great in primary care for behavioral science. It looks like the original group of HIPs that I trained were trained primarily as behavioral health providers, a variety of different training, psychology, social work. And now we've expanded, trained some nurse practitioners, and we have one MD who said, you know, I'll do the MD work 3 days a week, but I want to do the HIP work 2 days a week.
Wow.
So, that's cool.
That's super cool.
That's very cool, isn't it? I mean, so that kind of speaks to your question. Are they open? They're very open.
Yeah.
You know, they think this is the work that we need to be doing. And that's much of the work I do is to help healthcare systems move into delivery of integrated care. So I train primary care providers, nurses, and behavioral health clinicians.
HIPs.
HIPs.
Yeah, HIPs. Well, in the United States, they're and also Sweden, other countries, they're more likely to be called behavioral health consultants. So consultant speaks to a big shift that the behavioral health clinician makes in working in a context where the need is much greater than in our traditional settings. I mean, our traditional settings, meaning community health centers, were set up to take care of about 3% of the population. And in primary care, you're probably looking at 30 to, you know, really depending on the risk stratification, the clinic could be every patient. But I did a survey. I left my scientist job in Seattle and wanted to look at dissemination. So I went to rural healthcare and I went to Toppenish, Washington, tough little place on the Yakima Indian Reservation, and very few mental health resources at all. And I worked there about 6.5 years. How can we use ACT as well as other behavioral interventions in a fully integrated model to improve the health of the population?
And how did the people there respond? How did the people there respond, your patients?
Oh, they responded really well, and it was closely evaluated by the planning department. And so we had, you know, I was seeing like 10 to 15, 16, 17 people a day on group days. I had a big ACT-based chronic pain treatment program. I would see like 50 to 60 patients in a day, you know, through groups, some individual visits. And those are big numbers.
Those are huge numbers. Yeah. Did you get tired? Was it wearing for you to see that many people?
You know, I had to figure out a system. My passion was helpful, but the most helpful, and of course the logistics and problem solving, but the most helpful was being part of a team and being really appreciated. In a way, I was never appreciated that whole resetting.
Appreciation is wonderful, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and to be a part of the team.
Yeah.
So it was interdisciplinary care. We supported each other's work, and whoever was available pitched in to do anything they could.
Yeah. I have a little story to tell you, Patty. I'm a consultant for a hospital here. I don't need to go into that detail. And I meet with the clinicians to consult therapeutically client stuff. And what we have been doing recently is looking at those YouTube videos that Kirk uploaded. Terrible quality. But what we do is we go turn by turn.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the clinicians that I'm working with are saying, oh, that's ACT. It's just natural conversation.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful to watch him in like 15 minutes or less.
Yeah.
Do stuff like that. It's incredible. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I think over the years, we're getting better at teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
So we've moved to this care approach where we have worksheets that really teach very specific skills and just script it for new clinicians. I'm really looking forward to the ACBS pre-conference I'm doing with Marcia Sasano from New Zealand, one of my new colleagues from New Zealand. We'll be using some of those worksheets. And
are you going to make those worksheets available? Are you going to publish on that? Or
yeah.
I'm just thinking there's so many clinicians going, I want that worksheet. Where can I get it?
Yes, absolutely. I'll make them available. But I am also writing a book that's under contract right now that has to be finished by December. It'll be out this spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can actually buy that book. It'll be by Springer. You can buy specific chapters. So there'll be one chapter on assessment and
that's one cool chapter on
conceptualization and intervention and all the worksheets, as well as a lot of client dialogue like you're talking about will be in that.
What an amazing resource, even for people who aren't working in primary care, don't you think, Tim? I would want that, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes. And, you know, when Kirk and I, as we developed ACT, we were always working in primary care. So FACT is something that just kind of happened at the same time that ACT was developing, because it was focused on, you know, working in a population-based care model where you're focused on doing a little for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And there are many contexts where we work as psychologists and social workers and counselors that require us to be brief. So not just primary care, but I think many inpatient settings, jails, prisons, schools,
ERs, psych ERs.
Yeah.
Well, that's something that I want to ask you about, Patty, because you referenced this this early adaptation of CBT and your interest in comprehensive distancing. And I'm a big fan of your work. So just to kind of let our listeners in on it, like, what did you discover? Like, how brief could you get it? Like, how quick could you get an effect using this hybrid, this focused work?
Yeah, so I would say 10 to 15 minutes.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so, and we have just really cultivated a lot of skill in teaching this because it's so hard for people to move from using the habits they developed in their initial training.
Yeah.
Habits that enable us to fill up an hour, because somehow or another, it got into the Kool-Aid that that's what we were supposed to do. Is
right.
And there's never been a study that said we get better results if we spend an hour than if we spend 30 minutes. Those studies just haven't been done.
Yeah.
And so we get a lot of people saying yes to behavioral health services because we say, oh, these are short visits, 20, 25 minutes. If you only have 10 or 15, talk to her. She'll help.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool.
That's really cool.
I think in part, Tim, it's because people feel respected and open when they are offered help at the time they're asking. Another part is many times primary care providers have longstanding relationships with their patients.
Yeah.
And their patients trust them. They may have taken care of their parents, or you know, in some towns their grandparents. So
yeah, there's history there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so for them to say, I want you to see my colleague, she's probably available right now. She'll have some ideas for us. Do you have 15 minutes, 20 minutes? You get a lot of people. We see a lot more men, I think, in primary care than we see in traditional mental health settings when we work in primary care.
Because it's more okay for men to be physically ill than mentally ill or emotionally ill.
Yeah. Well, I think it's not just that. I think it's more than that.
What do you think it is?
The way we offer service is, let's just see if we can fix this. And that's more appealing to men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What problem is concerning you today? We're gonna see if we can help you with that problem and see if things get better. In fact, part of our standard introduction is to say, many people see us once, get some ideas, and go out and run with them, mm-hmm. and they don't come back.
Yeah.
You need to come back. You know, we're here and we'll help you learn some new skills for negotiating life.
How much do you think the DBT skills approach has influenced you and Kirk? I mean, my experience of DBT is it's so pragmatic.
Yeah.
You ask people to do things that, and they don't know how to do it, and you have to teach them. Mm-hmm. But you keep using the word skills. Yeah.
I've always been a skills person. I have not mm-hmm. formally gone through DBT training, so mm-hmm. I can't really speak to, I would have to say it hasn't influenced me that much because I haven't mm-hmm. been trained in it. Mm-hmm. But I was trained in CBT by Neil Jacobson and Steve Hall and Keith Dobson. And so, I mean, Peter Lewinson. So I know a lot about mm-hmm. teaching people skills. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with children and families as well as just adults. So I'm very behaviorally trained.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I can hear it.
I mean, I can figure out. In fact, that's kind of when we don't have a full 20, 25 minutes, we kind of skip what we call the contextual interview and act and move right into the problem context. So we do really a mini functional
analysis. Yeah.
Of the problem.
Yeah. Well, that's what struck me about the focused ACT work. I'm going to totally nerd out here. But like from Brief Interventions for Radical Change, I know my colleague and co-author Jessica Borschak and I, like, we obsess over these, and obsess is kind of an understatement, over these five questions. It's what are you seeking? What have you tried? What's worked? What's it cost you? Like, what's the toll you've paid in trying this? And how will you know that you're actually like chasing the life that's important to you? And that is so much fun right there. Just like those, yeah, just those cornerstone of that kind of mini functional analysis.
Yeah. And it's so clear. And you know, it's also, I think when we ask those questions and we ask them without an agenda, without an idea of what's right. And I think people really respond to that kind of open, respectful curiosity about their experience. And assuming that they're not dumb people. They've tried a lot of, you know, they've tried some stuff that, you know, wasn't necessarily a dumb idea.
There's a deep like authenticity and respect for their experience, I find, in that focused approach. Mm-hmm. And I frequently hear from my clients in the different kinds of settings that I work in, because I work with some pretty stuck people, and I'll hear them say things like, you know, this is the first time that somebody hasn't tried to arbitrarily assign some kind of category or some kind of like one size fits all kind of advice. Like, I felt like you were really trying to figure out what's going on for me. And regardless of, you know, what I've tried and how unattractive that might look, you know, like we're having real talk here about how that works.
Yeah. Patty, I want to come back to something you said earlier about the habits that are trained into us in grad school. And I do a fair amount of student teaching. One of the habits I see a lot of students struggling with is a sense that we should be omniscient in the room. We should never ask the client for information. And so it sounds like that we should just know what they need. Do you kind of focus on that when you help people transition?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, you're supposed to be omniscient and telepathic.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and I would say most people give up those habits very easily, but it takes a lot of structure, because if you're not going to do that, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And so we actually give people a question list, and we call it the contextual interview. And the first part is the life context, and the second is the problem context. So the life context is kind of our version of a psychosocial interview, but instead of doing it in 30 to 45 minutes, we do it in 5 to 7 minutes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of closed-ended questions, a really fast pace, which really brings the patient into the moment more.
And so you just said something really interesting. So you said a lot of closed-ended questions. Yeah. And in our training, that was like a mortal sin.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Right. We go after quite a few things.
Yes or no? Did you? Yeah.
Well, it's more like, you know, who's at home? Mm-hmm. Everything okay at home? Mm-hmm. You know, and what we're doing is we're trying to, you know, like whack-a-mole, that game at the arcade, take your kids to the arcade. We're just touching everything lightly to see what pops up more often. Mm-hmm. We can go back to something, but we want to get the whole context rather than go off in what we call a rabbit hole, where we waste a lot of time.
Yeah.
So that's why we do it. And I'd say people, the most common reflection I hear when people watch this the first time, you know, in the training, is, I can't believe how much we know about that person in 6.5 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, Kirk did some YouTube videos and posted them. Would you all ever consider doing something like that, to post the questions so people can actually see it? Or is that something that's part of your training?
No. You can go to behavioralconsultationandprimarycare.com.
Are you writing this down, Tim?
Got it. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And that has, it's just a very simple website that I developed with my co-author, Jeff Ryder. Mm-hmm. Jeff and I have written 2 books on behavioral consultation in primary care.
What are the titles of those books?
Same as the website, Behavioral Consultation in Primary Care, A Guide to Integrating Services. And they both have chapters on ACT, in them. And they have contextual interview questions and everything that's in the appendices or that's in a table or a figure are on the website.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.
From the first edition, there's clinical case examples, some with CBT and some with ACT, that I think would be helpful to people interested in, cool. trying these.
Yep. Behavioral consultation in primary care, it's in its second edition with Springer. This looks really cool, Patty. I'm going to put a link to all this in the show notes for our listen. But yeah, this...
You know, one of the things I'm thinking, Tim, right now is how hard it is for people who like Patty, who are super creative, working really hard, to get the word out about your work.
Yeah.
You know? I mean...
Yeah. Well, though, that's not been... a problem, it's because being a scientist, I present at conferences and I've been engaged in research and so it's going, and I go to a variety of scientific meetings every year, and it's, I never intended to be a consultant or a trainer, really. I was very happy with research and clinical work. But it's people come up to you and say, help us. Help us. And so I've worked a lot with the United States Air Force worldwide. And then all those people separate eventually from the Air Force and they go into the civilian world. And then I help them wherever they land. And then I, the Bureau of Primary Care, you know, the federal government has, you know, they're really concerned about the health of our population, the overall health. And we separate mental and physical, but it's all the same.
It's all one. Yeah.
It's all one. So they have funded a lot of federally qualified healthcare centers to start integrated services, and they even referenced Jeff and I's book and some of their funding.
Great.
So
I don't have any trouble getting the word out.
And Kirk, well, where I was going, it was not just, I mean, I think it's wonderful in those systems the word is out, but I'm thinking about frontline clinicians, you know?
Oh.
You know, our frontline community health workers, getting the word out to them, because it just seems like it's such a powerful intervention. And my experience of folk in that setting is very few tools that are effective. Do you know? Is that your experience, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, I want to speak to that because, Patty, something about your story really strikes me, which is like you're doing damn good work. And I think people see that and then they're like, help us innovate, because you're doing some truly innovative stuff. That's one of the things that draws like me to you and our friendship and our kind of the collegial like talking shop conversations that we have, Joanne, right? Is because you're doing like really innovative work. And I think regardless of whether you're a researcher or somebody who's trying to make a living out of doing training, I think it makes sense that people are going to see you're doing cool stuff and they're going to say, show me how to do what you're doing. Because my experience is that clinicians are largely not even totally sold on these clinical traditions and orientations. They just want stuff that works. Show me tool, worksheets or exercises. You know, I've even had people say, just give me the script of that mindfulness exercise that you do. Because I think that clinicians are hungry for stuff that legitimately works and not works with all due respect, but with a captive audience in a research type of setting, but they want stuff that they can reproduce themselves, that they can see working in their context that they're working in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the comments we get. People say, you know, I've been to ACT training and I get it, but I don't know how to do it.
Yeah,
no.
I hear that a lot. Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
But I was going to just make a comment about the kind of training I do. So I train people in group contexts you know, and do skill-based training, didactic, all of, you know, guided rehearsal. I do all of that in that learning context. But then I call it phase two. I go into their work setting.
Oh, wow.
I train them. So it's, and I use a competency-based training tool. So they know exactly what they're going to have to demonstrate.
That is so rock and roll.
Wow. That is the minimum that they're going to have to demonstrate. So, yeah, and I'll just plug this. I'm presenting with some of my friends from the Air Force at APA in San Francisco later this month, that, you know, where we're talking about that competency-based training. And then in back to linking to getting the word out, Joanne, it's for doing the work, it's competency-based work. And then the people that excel at the work, we train them to be trainers.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we have a competency tool for training them.
Mm-hmm.
We train them by watching them train somebody else.
How would someone who wanted to work with one of those trainers find them? Like if they weren't involved in the Air Force or in the government, how would they find those trainers?
Oh yeah. Well, through Mountain View Consulting Group.
Okay.
.com. My company, and I have right now have 5 associates and 2 more coming on, and then and they're all psychologists or social workers, mostly psychologists, 1 social worker, and then that's going to be a doctorate of behavioral health, and then 1 psychiatrist. So we try to have a variety of people.
Do your trainers do distance training, for example, Zoom training, video training? Say, for example, someone in Alabama wants to get this training. Do they need to come to Seattle to get it? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That would be great.
Yeah, we do. You know, web-based. I'm doing a lot of that since coming back from New Zealand, but we typically do on a combination kind of web-based, then we go on site, and then we follow up web-based support, phone support, email support, and then we go back. So we call it evolved primary care. So we're changing a whole system. But that system will be in a region that then has a trainer, so other clinics can come and
train from them. Train from them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've been working on one of the things I've been so concerned about is the opioid epidemic and the problems with pain. So I've been working a lot in both areas, hit the hardest. And I help people develop funding if they don't have funding for training, you know.
Wow. What an extraordinary resource.
Information. I mean,
Tim, this is what we also have to do with this podcast is get the word out, you know. People need to know what's out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're just furiously looking at the show notes right now, aren't you?
Well, I'm going to, if it's okay with you, Patty, I'd like to put your email in the show notes so that people can connect with you directly through there. Would that be cool? Or is there a better way that people could maybe like directly get in touch with you?
They can go through the website.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
You know, there's a way to contact me through the website, or they can email me, either one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you might put in there too about the basics of behavior change in primary care, that book, because that will have the really short, pretty short, 20, 25 page chapters that they can buy to get a lot of information and tools. And I have people, the work that particularly Jeff and I've done is, you know, just, but for sure with Kirk too, very open-hearted, open-handed. We want to empower people to do as much as they can on their own.
Mm-hmm. I'm really struck by that, the just absolute lack of ego involved in this. Yeah. It's just, I get that you are really coming from a place of deep service.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And they're like, oh, no one ever has to worry about running out of work when it comes to suffering. It's
like, no, we really don't. Unfortunately. Yeah.
I want to switch gears for a moment here. Because Patty, I mentioned this earlier in our podcast here. I've been a fan of your work for a long time. I've been to a number of your workshops. One of the things that Joanne and I had discussed that we wanted to spend time talking to people about on the podcast is like, what are the rough areas that you have? What are the difficult experiences that you have doing this work?
Different varieties, I guess three general areas. One is the travel. I'm on the road, you know, 70 to 80% of the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of travel.
I don't want to be away from family. So yeah. I, you know, figure ways to connect. And I'm trying to bring that down and do more web-based. So, and then I would say, very related is prioritizing what I say yes to. So I'm continuing to work on that. Rather than just be helpful, try to figure out how to be helpful the most. And then the other thing is the clinical situations that are most demanding. So I work a lot with underserved people and really prioritize that in my work with public health departments. And, so babies that are born addicted to drugs, people with limited resources for creating health, and refugees, and those are all really challenging, but I'm very optimistic about what we can do and ready to roll up my sleeves. It's hard.
Yeah, I've done some refugee related work. Most of it I've been privileged to be in a role of as a consultant sort of supervisor. And one of the things that I've struggled with when working with supervisees or consultees is to really stay true to these more kind of behavioral models. And one of the mantras that I say, that I repeat, is because I find when some of these systemic issues are so severe, barriers, you know, like you were saying, Patty, to... To just
decent food.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Barriers to these necessities.
Clean water.
I can find it's easy to become a crappy case manager, because you get so caught up in those systemic things. And I'm grateful to have these behavioral tools, and I find it really empowering to.
What's the mantra? You said you do a mantra. What is it?
The mantra is that I'll say,
don't be a crappy case manager.
I'll say you have two options right now. Option number one is you can be a really crappy case manager, and option number two is you can be a damn good therapist. Like, which one are you going to elect to be here? Yeah. Right. Is it so easy to get caught up in those systemic kind of factors?
Huh? Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think about that, Joanne?
For me, I would find it really hard to separate. So I think you're seeing something. No, I mean, it wouldn't be hard. I wouldn't be trying to separate it. I wouldn't want to separate it. Yeah. So, I don't have a vast amount of experience working with that population. My population, I'm in private practice, and I do work with people who are severely traumatized. But they usually do have resources. So that's a very, very narrow, very, very tiny part of the world. So I'm really interested in hearing what you two have to say about this prioritization, you know, time prioritization, 15, 20 minutes, amazing. And then, in my 15 minutes, am I going to be a case manager or am I going to be a change agent, really? You know, that in those videos, if anyone has a chance, go look at those videos. What you see Kirk do is in like 15 minutes transform a person's perception of reality, what's possible. It's astonishing.
Absolutely. You know,
you can see people having thoughts they've never thought before. Mm-hmm. Do you see that a lot, Patty, in your work where people just...
Yeah, I think people shift their perspectives
really
quickly at the right moment when we're there at the right moment and have a strong belief in them and the possibilities in their lives. And that's what our brief kinds of assessments do, is help us better understand their strengths and their skill deficits, and do targeted kind of intervention that's really focused around what their priority is, the problem they're worried about, not me. And not diagnosis. We're really very focused on functioning and vitality.
I'm reminded of a story that I was taught when I was learning behaviorism about a behavior analyst who was helping someone learn how to tie their shoes. And finally the person said, "Okay, I'll tie my shoes. Stop giving me those M&Ms. I don't want those."
Terrible.
Right? Isn't that great? Isn't that a great story? But that quality of like, we know what is reinforcing for you. We know what you need. It's like, no, we don't.
Yeah.
You know, so that really sounds like you train people to go into the room open and curious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I want to know about you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're the expert on you, not me.
Yeah.
Don't give me any more of those M&Ms. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, well put.
Yeah. Tim, do you have anything else you want to talk about today?
Actually, there was something we haven't talked about that I think might be kind of fun. We've talked a little bit about like some of those sticking points. I was also thinking, like, Patty, what kind of pro tips do you have? Like, what are some of the high level pieces of, I don't want to say advice, but some of the insights that you've had? Because I mean, 30 years is a long time to be doing this work. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because I imagine, like, when I look at the focused work, like the focused fact work, it's very streamlined. It's very elegant. And you must have like some damn good pro tips to share with people, things that you've learned over that long career, the insights that you find, you know, your kind of go-tos in consultation.
Or maybe since you've trained so many people, common errors that people make, they're going to make that error in their training progress.
Yeah.
It's not personal. It's not anything about the clinician or the trainee. It's just, people get stuck on that one all the time.
Yeah. I think I would say be in charge of time, you know, be responsible for how your time is used with the patient, you know, and make sure as much of it as possible counts towards change.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, of course means a lot of things. Be present.
Mm-hmm. Interrupt too.
Oh yeah.
Interrupt people. You know, is this what we really need to be talking about right now?
Yeah.
Is this in your best service right now? Yeah.
Or just shift quickly. Oh, I also wanted to know. So there's ways of interrupting that help people just come into the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, listen for the person's strengths, incorporate those, into what you're doing. Let them know you see those strengths. And always, no matter how long or short your contact with the patient is, always develop a behavioral experiment coming out of the visit and check to see that they're talking about the bottle, because it's really about behavioral variability. If they don't do something different, they're not going to get different outcomes. So I always do that.
And can you give us an example of a behavioral experiment you might suggest to a person?
You know, it's all kinds of things. It might be to discuss a metaphor that we talked about with a friend, or it might be some kind of change in their behavior, a nature walk every morning at 10 or something for 10 minutes, or it might be waking in the morning and reflecting on a value, setting an intention for the day. Just very short, brief, specific, measurable, often monitored, self-monitored behavior change experiments to see, you know, is it feasible? Will it work in your life? Mm-hmm. And, does it have an impact on your vitality?
Mm-hmm. Is it a pivotal move?
Yeah.
You know, if just one small thing, like brushing your teeth, is that a pivotal move that, you know, cascades other more effective moves after it? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Or, you know, does it make a difference?
Yeah.
Sense of vitality for that day, for that moment. Mm-hmm. Is it something you want to cultivate and grow and, you know, add on to? I think one mistake people often make is to think it has to be real complex and there has to be a list of five things, because we can think of seven and we got it down to five. And I think a lot of times we're better off with one or two.
Mm-hmm. I love the specificity of these really tight, these really small, easy to imagine interventions. I hesitate to even call them interventions, like just violations of those kind of stuck kind of patterns and the
specificity
of these tightly titrated, right? Like these small behaviors. That's just
very precise.
Yeah.
There's a lot of precision. And I'm just thinking, if you got that much context of the person, you can make those kind of precision interventions around that. So
and I always write them, or have the patient or client write them. And I started this back at Group Health in Seattle in 1990-something, when I was just first doing, kind of moving to model development from research. And we were still in paper charts at the time. I had an older man come in, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, looking at paper charts, trying to figure out what, you know, the situation is with him. And I look up and start to give my standard introduction. And he's just grinning at me and leaning over the table. And I'm like, wow, what's going on here? And, you know, just really attracted to his smile. And I says, well, you know, I'm not sure what you're here for, but we'll talk. Have a seat. And he says, wait a minute. And I said, what? He says, you don't remember me? And I'm like, I will. Let's just And he reaches back and he pulls out of his back pocket his wallet, and he opens it up, and he has this crumpled little piece of paper, and he says, you see this? You wrote this. It's been 2 years.
and I
need a tune-up.
Wow.
I love that. And the language, I need a tune-up. That's awesome. Yeah.
I really love that. I will remember. I don't write the second, but I will. I'm thinking, I'm going to steal that, because I never know what to say. And it's true. If give me a minute, it will come.
Yeah.
I know. It's in there somewhere. What a great story. What an amazing story.
It is. For 2 years, my words, his plan, our work, had been right in there by his money.
It's incredible. That's a really great story, Patty.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Write it down. Well, there's evidence now for after visit summaries and everything, but stories are wonderful.
That is such a great story.
Yeah. It's touching, right? And I love this idea that, again, that these behavioral experiments, these tightly titrated behaviors, can really stick to our clients and make a difference to them in their world. And, and these aren't these grandiose interventions like Dr. Joanne or Patty, like these uber complex things. You know, it's just us really getting into their, into the muck of some of their difficult stuff and helping them plan some things. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful.
We are always asked as a check on the behavioral experiment, if you did this, you know, could it work within a step towards doing what matters in your life? Mm-hmm. Could it? Would it be consistent with the value that's most important for you right now?
Could you speak a little bit about how you do quick values for clarification with people? Oftentimes people get really boogered up in that, you know? So I'm wondering how you, how would you answer that question if the client didn't know what mattered?
Well, you know, I think I don't run into people that say they don't know. I mean, what I run in more is more they say it, but they're not connected to it, you know, or they're, you know, they're not clear about it, or what they say is not, maybe not really values talk. And so I just lean in, and if we have trouble kind of getting that heart connection with a value, then that's probably the intervention for that visit. And so I just, you don't have to fix everything.
No.
That's the most important.
I think if someone can touch into what matters to them, that's a massive life change.
That's right.
Massive. Right. You know? Yeah, I see a lot of people getting all tied up in, you know, intellectual stuff about values, and it's really physical. There's a felt sense that this matters.
I get people into their bodies a lot. Yeah, as you all know, I'm also a yoga teacher. So.
Yeah, Tim definitely wanted to talk about that too.
Big time.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever told you this, Tim, but before I became a clinician, I was a body worker. I was a massage therapist for 5 years. Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. So bodies for me are so integral to the work.
Yeah.
You know, and they, you get so much information by just observing someone's body.
Yeah.
Anyway, talk about yoga.
I have to say, I've been a licensed massage therapist for 20 years.
Oh, good. Cool. So you know what I'm talking about, right?
Just did it as a sabbatical when I was like, had been working a lot with chronic pain. And I thought, well, I really want to better understand the muscles and kinesiology. So, and it was a wonderful thing. And, you know, it was great. And it made me a better family member, I think.
Oh, really?
You know, it's a good life skill.
Yeah, and it is a good life skill.
Yeah, yoga is a good life skill, too. And I practiced yoga since my 20s, so.
So how do you integrate body work into your work that you do, Patty?
I don't. I understand the body and I can talk about it and use images. And so I think it empowers my language in ways that connects with people.
So Patty, as a massage therapist, have you ever had the experience where you're kind of moving into a really congested or tight area for a person and they start to seize and you back out? Like, micro, you know, and then it relaxes and then you go back in. And you have to follow that relaxation. I find for me clinically that I learned as a massage therapist is very much of what I'm doing interpersonally. That just, I'm not backing completely out, but I'm stepping a little bit back, let them release and go in a little bit further.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would, and that's true for a yoga pose too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Less is more. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Graciela Roebner, I've had conversations with her too. You know, she's a physiotherapist. It does help. It really helps to have a different perspective, that it's enriching to have more than one perspective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I see yoga, you know, in Sweden I'm going to do some short classes at the beginning and the end of the workshop days, all 6 days. But I don't really integrate it that much in terms of clinical work, but I add it on to training. Just as a way to help people get in their bodies and process what they're learning.
Yeah.
And of course, pranayama and breathing techniques are just really useful when you're working on present moment and perspective and acceptance and open, aware, engaged. All of it is, you know, you can use anything that helps them move.
Too, on a really pragmatic level, and someone realizes that when they get anxious, they stop breathing, and when they stop breathing, they get anxious.
Yeah.
It's not some sort of attack. It's just, this is what bodies do.
Right.
It's super powerful for people.
That's valuable information to be able to track. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Am I breathing? No. Am I panicking? Yes. Maybe those two go together.
Yeah. I really like yoga with children. Because it's so much there is so much easier for them to get into their bodies and combine breathing and movement. So I just finished a book, and we'll see where it goes, with my daughter and her partner and my grandson, that incorporates yoga and ACT.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Do you have a title? Is there...
Great.
Yeah, Leo Learns from Crow.
Oh, my goodness.
That's awesome.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. If there's any acquisition editors out there, get on this now.
Totally.
Yeah. It's for like second graders that are bullied in school, and teaches them some, and their parents, some yoga poses, and, you know, key messages to recover quickly and respond with compassion and interest and the ability to create social change that will lessen the pressures on bullies in the world.
Yeah. Wow.
That sounds really cool.
Sounds amazing. Yeah. That sounds super amazing.
So I have one last kind of question about this kind of integrated body stuff. So how do each of you use the body in your sessions at all then, or information that comes from body? Because we talked a little bit about like noticing when you're not breathing and how that might inform some of your work. But what are some other ways that each of you kind of conceptualize the bodies that people bring through the doors with them into a session? How might you use any of that data, if at all?
No, I'm not thinking about what you're asking. Patty, do you pay a lot of attention, like on purpose, to people's bodies when you're working with them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm a yoga teacher.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so yeah. I'm looking and I feel like their bodies just say so much. And that's kind of, that goes back to kind of the way we do assessment with kind of standard questions and stuff like that. I don't have to be thinking about what I'm going to ask or where I'm going to go. I know what I'm going to cover, so I can really, really tune in to moment changes in the body, where their eyes are, any kind of change in their mouth, any kind of change in their breathing, any kind of shift in their posture, you know, where their eyes are looking, are not looking. And I, so if I can see all that, then I'm able to kind of slow down when I want to and stop and, you know, enhance the emotional experience at a moment and then pick up the pace again. But yeah, I'm watching all the time. I think I learn a lot about a person's psychological flexibility from that, watching their body.
Absolutely. And as their sex, as their psychological sex, bleh, flexibility starts to open up, you see it actually in the body. And the way the body is, the way person inhabits their body starts to change.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I worked with one woman and when she came to see me, you probably can't see this. She had her knees and her ankles locked and her hands folded in a locked position on her lap. And that's how she sat for the whole session. Well, hideous trauma stuff, right? And as we've worked, she's actually, she puts her feet up, she moves around. It's amazing. But what she realizes is when she gets caught up in her kind of trauma related, you know, behavior, her body immediately takes on that, that pit posture immediately. Yeah. And it starts a feedback loop.
What a great observation and piece of data as a clinician to be sensitive to that. And I'm assuming like you used that in the session. That's really cool. Go ahead, Joy.
Go ahead. No. I was going to ask both of you. I mean, I deal with a lot of people, like I said, with pretty severe trauma. And one of the things that I experience with people is they work very, very hard not to have any sensation at all.
Yes.
Not to be able to acknowledge or... So I'm wondering if, you know, that's something that the two of you have encountered and kind of what you do with that. Do you have that, Patty? Or people are just, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I do. I work with that, of course. You know, I do, you know, if a body scan is too threatening, I may do some other kind of humorous, you know, breathing technique that uses, you know, like breathing into your hands or your arms or your nose and your upper left chest. I just go to, you know, different kinds of breathing techniques that move them into their body. I might design something based on an area of their body that feels good or is interesting to them.
Like what?
Well, I might say, you know, you've told me that it's difficult for you to, you know, become aware of your body, particularly, you know, your body between your shoulders and your knees. Much you feel your feet and you can feel your head. What part of your body would you like to kind of like tune into for a few minutes? Just to experiment with directing your attention.
Wow.
I'm totally going to use that like today.
Good.
Yeah. I don't know who taught me this, but I really like this one too. For someone who's incredibly phobic around body stuff, I'll have them put their hand like on their thigh or their knee or something. And I'll ask them, can you feel your hand on your knee? Yes. Okay. Put your hand. Can you feel your hand on your knee? Yeah, I can feel my hand on my knee. Can you feel your knee on your hand? And cool. People usually can. And it's a very sort of benign thing. It's not, you know, tell me about how your genitals are feeling right now. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that sort of equivalence kind of training stuff. So for me, when it comes to the body, I don't know why I do this, but I tend to say this to clients. I'll give them a little bit of an informed consent. And I'll say, can we try something that might be really weird? Mm-hmm. And I'll invite them to do like a little miniature kind of yoga practice where I'll have them just turn their hands, have them inhale, turn their hands from palms face down to palms face up.
Oh, cool.
Lift their hands, exhale, drop their hands. And in the same exhale, turning their palms face down. And I'll pause a little bit while they're doing that and just kind of, without even eliciting feedback from them, just have them notice anything that might be showing up for them. Notice the sensations of your movement. Notice mm-hmm. where you feel the breath in your body. Notice mm-hmm. if your mind has anything to say about this, like this is really weird. But I won't take a lot of time or any time at all to elicit direct feedback from them. I'll just kind of almost like it's a mindfulness exercise, just kind of guide them through mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And I'll usually use that as my intro to kind of experimenting with noticing the body more and using the body. Mm-hmm. And then I also find myself, I'm coming up with this sort of judgment. My mind is like, you know, this is going to sound totally like, you know, like a Fritz Perls move from the
Gloria. Stop being Canadian. Stop apologizing.
The maple syrup is in my blood, Joanne. Hey, you guys want to go play some hockey, eh?
All right. What are you going to say, Tim?
Well, one of the next things that I'll do is just sort of bring their attention. Like I loved when you were talking about this idea that just tracking what they're doing with their eyes. And I'll even pause and I'll say, did you just notice, as we were discussing this, I noticed your eyes got really wide and you didn't just move your eyes to look away, like your whole body like moved away. Could we kind of pause and just return to that and feel the stickiness that was going on there and what that was like? To just kind of replay those kind of little micro moments in our session, as I'm kind of conceptualizing it as more of like an in vivo exposure in the session. I don't know what you two think about that, but that's kind of one of the ways that I really conceptualize this body-based experience stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the best exposure happens when you're sitting across from the client. Do you know?
That's cool.
I mean, it's right there.
Yeah.
Whatever it is right there. And it's not, you know, like Patty, you were saying, it's not some big elaborate, you know, thing. It's these little back and forths. Yeah, what were you going to say? I'm sorry, I interrupted you, Patty.
Oh, no. No, I was just going to build on what Tim was saying. You know, I'll do things like rub the hands together to create mm-hmm. warmth, feel mm-hmm. the warmth.
I like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and then feel the warmth again and then place it on their heart. Mm-hmm. You know, at a moment to, you know, where maybe they're acting with a little more courage, you know, so that they start to develop a cue for encouraging themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And to just mm-hmm. really connect with the warmth in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be there, but you can generate it
mm-hmm. you know,
in your body. In your mind, you can generate it. There mm-hmm. is that capacity to add on and add in.
I like that because it's not a sort of a talky kind of thing. You know, are you saying positive things to yourself? You know, it's just that it's that physical, you know, and with this going on, you know, your hand on your chest saying it's okay, you can do this, is going to feel so much less wrong for someone who struggles with encouraging themselves.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm stealing it. It's mine now.
Okay.
Oh man. This is such a great conversation.
This has been really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another version of that is, if you like that, Jillian, is to use the hands again when they are seeing something difficult that they haven't wanted to see, to create kind of just some warmth and kindness by floating their hands up and letting them just kind of rest over their eyes and
sort of let their hands cover their eyes so that they can move them and glimpse what they're seeing in a very gentle kind of way.
No, not so much control, but comfort, to comfort while seeing, to bring that warmth and have that space.
Like the actual sensation of warmth from the hands that you've just generated from rubbing the hands.
So some of the people who are listening to podcasts will only be listening to it, so they won't know.
Oh, okay.
So we probably need to describe what just happened. So Patty rubbed her hands together in front of her face, and then she took her hands and she put them fingers up over her eyes.
Yeah, palms facing.
Palms facing the eyes, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And really,
very gently, sort of, letting the heat from the hand go into that whole area around the eyes.
And just providing kind of comfort and shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think it can help people that have a lot of rules about not crying often around. Yeah, crying is an okay kind of.
Well, it's often for many people dangerous.
Yeah.
In their history, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very powerful stuff. I love that last, just this last little discussion about these kind of physical practices and opening ourselves up to different sensations. You know, the rubbing of the hands. Even just placing the hand on the knee, you know, feeling under the hand, feeling the hand over the knee, you know, like through the knee. From the hand. It's just really cool stuff. Novel approaches to doing this really good work in a way that I think is just going to open. It's today. It's opened me up to some different things that I'm going to experiment with this afternoon.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, you know, it doesn't have to be chronic pain or trauma. Many people have no clue what's going on in their body. They're not attending. You know, they're just not attending.
Oh, yeah. I do this all the time with couples. Yeah. I mean, how easy is it to become insensitive to some of those cues, right? When you're interacting with somebody whose face you see every day, whose eyes are easy to take, you know? I love doing some, you know, some physical kind of breaks in the session to kind of go into sensations. And maybe we could kind of begin to wrap up around this topic, but I'd argue, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Patty and Joanne, that body-based work, those sensations, even the hands rubbing, the hand on the knee is a really great present moment challenge to people because it's data that's only available to them here and now, you know, rather than, you know, some of these, if you will, more advanced versions of learning how to be mindful or in the present moment, but sensation that's only available right now. And it's stuff that, you know, you can tune into here and now and train yourself in a very concrete way.
It's also committed action.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
You know? I mean, committed action doesn't have to be some ticker tape parade, you know? Sometimes it's something as simple as, will you put your hands here? Would you rub your hands together? And the answer is yes for some. It's huge for some people. It's enormous. That's an enormous move.
That's cool.
Yeah. I don't know for you all, but for me, I mean, ACT is so embedded in everything that I see and everything that I do in my life. Right? I'm always seeing the processes, the hexaflex, the inner hexaflex. I'm very old school, no matrix here. It's all hexaflex. I just just wonder if that's the case for the two of you, that, you know, because you've been doing it a long, long time. Has it sort of seeped into your way of seeing the world?
For me, yes. I mean, unquestionably, I joke, like, you know, I see contingencies everywhere. Mm-hmm. I can't help it. Mm-hmm. At the local grocery store, mm-hmm. and hanging out, and when I'm, you know, having a conversation with, you know, my family or with my neighbor, mm-hmm. right? I mm-hmm. see mm-hmm. these processes play everywhere I go, mm-hmm. and in myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Patty, what about you? Do you feel that that's accurate for you? Maybe not ACT, but the functional analysis, the functional contextualism.
Yeah, for sure. ACT or mm-hmm. FACT. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see the world that way. It was a interesting process for me. It took a while. Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of. Mm-hmm. Because I was so trained in learning theory first, uh-huh. and, you know, and now I see them all together.
Yeah.
That's a cool fun,
I have a funny story, Patty. I went to Reno, the second Worldcon was my first exposure to ACT. Yeah. And I emailed Steve, you know, and I said, what do you suggest that I read or so I can prepare? And he said, well, just read Catania.
Yeah, a little light reading.
So I get this book, right? And I'm opening it and I understand every word in the sentence and I have no idea what it means. Oh my God. It was so funny. It's like read Catania. But I think for someone like Steve, that is like an ABC book with that kind of history. Yeah. Read Catania.
Anyway. No big deal.
Yeah.
Man. That's funny.
That is funny.
You know, I think the benefit of the like broad applicability, the generalization of the work that we're talking about has also like to move beyond like something that seems so anecdotal, like, you know, seeing it in conversations that I have with family or how I see it at, you know, when I see a parent interacting with their child at the supermarket, it's allowed me to be able to apply this to any situation that I'm working in, like organizational, in my training situations, mm-hmm. You know, in how I even think about some of the policy work that I do and how like policies get constructed. I find that this is truly is a foundational science that can be applied to all these different domains of life, which is kind of cool.
I agree.
I really found it very useful in working with primary care clinicians and burnout.
Something about that. That's important. Yeah, because we really want to talk about burnout in this podcast.
Yeah. I wrote a book called Real Behavior Change in mm-hmm. Primary mm-hmm. Care. Mm-hmm. And you can put that on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the subtitle is Improving Outcomes and Increasing Job Satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So that book is with Deb Gould, a physician, and Kirk Strassel. And we introduce ACT and then use the bullseye with a variety of different clinical problems that are quite common in mm-hmm. primary care, trauma, depression, chronic disease. Mm-hmm. And then the last third of the book is on using a version of the bullseye we call the professional bullseye
mm-hmm.
To clarify your values and four areas, including relationships with colleagues, practicing mm-hmm. your work, and your health and your balance of work and play. That's kind of the way we divided it up. It also has a primary care provider stress checklist mm-hmm. that helps them assess sources of stress in different domains.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a primary care provider AAQ that's a part of that mm-hmm. That chapter, and we have some case examples. And I, mm-hmm. I've developed that further and provide trainings in what's called spirited primary care, and I've trained other people to do that, and find it's just really helpful to primary care providers that are, you know, really stressed by their work, to help them, you know, get a handle on why to stay with it. What we have is really high burnout rate in primary care. And it starts really in medical school. And right. just
Speaking of people who are trained to be omniscient.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
You have every one of the answers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not associated with medical errors, but it's associated with leaving the field prematurely. And family medicine is an area we don't have enough people.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to lose a doc and cost a lot of money to replace them. So, ACT is very, very useful. And I think Frank Bond's book, you know, Life Effectiveness Training is just awesome resource.
You got that, Tim? Show notes? Tim has the capacity to write and think and talk at the same time. I do not.
Multi-core processor.
Yeah, have no ability to do that.
No, that's a great book. It's funny. I had read that some time ago and I'd forgotten about it. And it's a, yeah, that's a really good piece of work.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank our listeners for hanging in with us. It is such a pleasure to have you back on this ACT in Context podcast reboot. Don't forget, we're going to have the show notes for you. So check out those show notes if you're on the podcast app. Or of course, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see the video of our conversation with Patty Robinson, myself, Joanne Steinwax. The show notes will include, I'm going to throw in the links to those fact videos because those are awesome. They're such a cool course on YouTube. As well as the websites. Your website has the contact information for you, Patty. And definitely hang in there with us. Of course, email us, actincontextpodcast@gmail.com, or hit us up on Twitter, actincontext. Thank you so much. Any final words before we say goodbye, Joanne or Patty?
No, just thank you very much, Patty. This has been a delightful, delightful conversation. You know, really wonderful. Thank you.
We're going to give you the last word, Patty.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated speaking with you this morning. Wish you the best in your work. I think podcasts are a great way to get the word out to people.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Patty. Okay.